Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Hello, and welcome to Weekly Monotony, the official podcast of the entertainment blog DailyMonotony.com, where all the internet will look up and shout, "Give us a 30-minute podcast," and we'll look down and whisper, "No." My name, of course, is Dustin Anglin, your humble host.
And I'm your other non-humble host, Mr. Scott Johnsgard, not doctor today, but in Raha.
And so it's only us this time, but that's okay, because we have a great movie to talk about. I'm sure we'll have a lot of fun things to say about it. But first
off, you have to see the movie to talk about it.
Well, of course you need to see the movie to talk about it, and that's part of the reason why we do not have someone else with us tonight. But that we'll go into that more as this show goes on. And also, hopefully, we're giving a bit of a shorter format, so we're back into a normal series. So we're not doing the best of anymore since we've covered most of that. And we are now going into sort of talking about what we've been watching and then going into a review of something that we've watched during the previous week. And this week, of course, is Zack Snyder's adaptation of Watchmen. And we might even throw a game in there, too, depending if we can get some good video game people to come and talk with us. But so that's going to be the format. Hopefully we'll be able to keep this under an hour. We'll see how we do. But first off, let's go straight into what we've been watching since our last podcast, since it's been a while, so I'm sure things have accumulated, but we'll bring out the stuff that's interesting. So, Scott, why don't you start us off?
Well, I actually finally went and saw The Reader.
Hey!
Did you? Ooh, Oscar nominee! Won some Oscars.
Yeah, did you enjoy the amazing performance, the Oscar-winning performance by Kate Winslet?
After seeing Happy-Go-Lucky, I refuse to acknowledge that category this year.
You don't think saying "Hey, kid" is enough to earn you Oscar props?
Merely the sort of Teutonic hairstyling that she had should have won them the makeup Oscar. But I remain skeptical. There were a lot of strong performances in the actress category, and I'm just not convinced that disgruntled former person who joined ZSS in 1942. It's really an acceptable reason to win one.
And don't you feel that Ralph Fiennes totally got looked over for his really actually pretty stunning performance there?
He was pretty strong in this film. Maybe they were punishing him for doing the Duchess. I don't know.
for doing the Duchess and doing Harry Potter.
Well, Harry Potter won't even be mentioned on this podcast. But The Reader. Unendingly long.
It was.
I really was fidgeting a lot, and that's coming from somebody who has like the opposite of ADHD. I have like the still disorder. So, so many times it could have ended, and I would have been happy. I'd be like, we could just roll the credits right here, and it'd be a great European ending.
Sure.
Good for a European movie. All these British people pretending they're Germans. Not like that's a historical irony, but. I don't know. The plot didn't compel me that much. I mean, the only character who was very interesting was, like, no one.
Well, I thought the kid was interesting, and I thought Ralph Fiennes was interesting, but that's about it.
Yeah, the Winslet character was sort of mechanical.
It was very subdued, too. Like, there was very little emotion to her part. It was like she was either... like being overly sexual with the kid, or just being like, "Hey, what's going on?" Or being like a deer caught in the headlights when she's brought before the trial, and she's like, "What was I supposed to do? The people were burning, and we had to make sure that they did not escape." It's like, Okay, that's Oscar for you.
Yeah, I think this film would have done much better if the Nazi scenes from The Spirit had been interposed occasionally.
If Sam Jackson had come out to the German national anthem.
Also, as much as it went jumping around temporally and stuff, there were some confusing moments and also some, you know, a lot of jetsam that just could have been injected.
Sure.
Like all of the scenes with the family basically were completely spurious and unnecessary.
You didn't get much from it other than the kid is sort of broken off from his family and I guess taken his own path or something. But the whole like affair thing in the beginning, I didn't really get how that tied into the rest of the movie of, you know, of this guy sort of feeling like he'd been betrayed and used by this woman, and then later on teaching her how to read, and I didn't feel like there was a strong message coming out of it, and I didn't feel like there were really that many strong performances coming out of it, which I was surprised it got so much laud and approval from the Academy, but. It is the Academy.
Yeah, and a lot of, you know, if you want to talk about the literary devices in the film, and, you know, sure. I'd be remiss not to. There was a lot of really overwrought symbolism.
Sure.
A construction motif, which you may have noticed throughout the film.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, yeah, sure.
I think, if you watch for it closely, there's construction just about any time you see a cityscape
right.
in the background.
Right,
it's a changing nature of his relationship, his personality, something like that. It doesn't make any sense, as far as I'm concerned, because it's so touche.
And
the Winslet character washing out the milk bottle after the sex
sure.
is ended. I mean,
right. The obvious.
Please, just take the milk bottle, beat it across the side of the sink so it's sharp, and then plunge it into me, and I'll notice.
Yeah. No, I also had a problem sort of placing it temporally. Like I didn't know whether like that first scene where he's having the affair with this woman was taking place before or after World War II, because they didn't really do a good job of placing Germany in the war at all. It was sort of like nice, happy, rural Germany, and then it was nice, happy, rural Germany and the kids in college. I was like,
right, you have to be watching the dates down at the bottom. That was something that confused my roommate, who thought the affair was before the war.
But it wasn't.
But if you do the dates, it doesn't work out, and another reason that's confusing is because you see, while they're having the affair or something like that, she gets promoted working for the train station and then leaves.
Sure. See, in
the court, you hear that she went in and joined the SS after she was offered a promotion working for Siemens.
Okay.
So roommate thought they were conflated the two, but that's not the case. Siemens doesn't run electric trams.
I actually thought that too the first time I thought it. I thought when we see her being promoted, we see her being promoted into the SS. And also because we see the kid buying like Nazi stamps at the very beginning, and I thought that would be sort of a weird thing to be doing after the war, but yeah, go figure.
But no, if you watch the dates closely, that's in 1955.
Okay, it made sense, I guess.
The Winslet character was born in 22 and is obviously in her 30s when the affair occurs.
Right, and the kid obviously never has to go off to war, and his parents obviously aren't in the war, there can't have been enough time to pass between the sort of his high school age to him being in college and like World War II happening somewhere in between.
Right.
So.
It was sort of a big deal.
Yeah. Well, either way, so that's The Reader. What else have you been watching?
Well, you know, you have your occasional television outings, all of which are listed on our website, dailymonotony.com, all of which we watch, all of which are fascinating, except for the ones we don't watch. I'm looking forward, actually, not something I've seen, but tomorrow, ABC at, I believe it's 10 Eastern, 9 Central, Castle.
Oh, yeah, with Nathan Fillion.
Nathan Fillion, somebody who hasn't been getting a lot of work, who I'm sure every sci-fi fanboy in our audience is
familiar
with.
Yeah, like, so I've been seeing the commercials for that, but I'm sort of reluctant to get excited about it because it's a cop drama, or it's a cop comedy drama, and I...
Comedy, funny, drama, cookie-cutter story,
I think. I hate cop dramas, or I hate cop comedies. It's like, how many shows about cops do we need? I'm sick of it. Like, throw me a curveball, throw me something different, which sucks because, I mean, it's Nathan Fillion. It looks like he's going to be really cool in it, but I just really don't want to see another, like, the goofy guy against, like, you know, like, the hard-ass cop woman. It's like, that's the most overdone concept in the world.
Well, that's what you're getting. And also today we had AMC's Breaking Bad, which unfortunately I'm going to have to watch tomorrow. But at least I'm a big fan of that here at Daily Monotony.
Sure.
And you should be, too. It's a great show.
I've been still watching Lost.
I actually gave up my Lost habit,
what?
You know. it was time to move on to greater and better things. Now, I realize that does sound sort of blasphemous. Lost is better watched in chunks,
I guess.
And Wednesday evenings, you know, it's always a special time.
Oh man, Lost has been getting really good recently. Like, there was a couple episodes, maybe a couple weeks back, which were kind of meh, but like last week's episode was awesome. It's like I really love what they're doing with it right now. So I'd highly recommend if you ever watch Lost, like this is a great time to get back into it. So, but yeah, good grief, Scott, get back in the Lost. It's good.
Watch it.
I honestly this season have not tuned in since the premiere. I don't think.
Wow.
But you know, Lost is good in chunks. Go.abc.com, HD.
That's sure.
Good quality.
Yeah, I mean,
nice way to catch up with the show and far less commercial interruption.
That's sure. It's a
thing if you're watching it broadcast.
Great way to watch it if you don't have DVR and can't make the
just
go shows.
Away.
Yep.
Yeah. Go New Media.
Cool. Have you been playing anything besides Rock Band 2 in the past couple weeks?
Actually, a little Gears of War 2. Still haven't beat the campaign in that.
Really?
Been working on that. I agree with you. It's a very derivative game with some frustratingly difficult and poorly placed checkpoint sequences.
Yeah, and so since we're not actually doing the worst games of 2008, like I'll go ahead and say it here, but Gears of War 2 was my best game of 2008 that I absolutely hated, and I could go into a litany of reasons why, but it not only did it feel incredibly derivative, but the story made no sense whatsoever. Like, it felt like they were throwing new story arcs, like, at every other cutscene, and they're like, oh, they're going below ground. Oh, but no, we gotta go back above ground, so we can come back below ground, so we can go back above ground, and oh, by the way, there's a civil war going on with the people, and some of them glow, and the end. It's like, what?
Spoiler.
It's like, I have no idea what is this? And okay, good, yeah.
I mean, to spoil a little bit more, there's this horrendous side arc about, you know, the Dom or
Dom and
other
his
character.
and his wife, right?
Going after this lady Maria, who's his wife or whatever. One of my roommates, who's a game designer, was watching while I was playing this, and that cutscene played out. At the end of which, he was screaming and hopping up and down, yelling, "That's not how it works," because I don't think human emotions work that way.
Yeah. I can understand what they were doing there. I don't think they succeeded, but I don't think it was completely like done incorrectly. But still, it was a stupid aside. And it was dumb for them to try to interject real human emotions into this game. That was totally the wrong way to go. And they should have come up.
It should be about chainsawing a human person in half.
And that,
or
like,
non-human person.
That, you know, if you want to have like a cool, you know, overriding story arc, that's fine. But make it coherent. Like, there's that one side quest level. I'm not sure if you got into it. Where like you go back above ground randomly. You go off to this one magic facility. You do all this crazy stuff there, and then you leave and never forget about it. It's like, well, that was a fun, weird side quest with possibly a huge story arc tied to it. But we gotta go back below. We gotta go underground again.
The insane sentient computer copy of a personality.
Yeah.
I'd sort of erased that from my mind. The cliche detectors went off, sure. And then I just locked it down, shut down my central nervous system.
But the gameplay was still fun. So, like, I enjoyed... It's still good Gears, and there's still some really cool sequences, too. Like, going through the worm was awesome. And, like, cutting out its heart valves is awesome. But, yeah.
The future cardiothoracic surgeons were trained for that game.
But yeah, beyond that, I really disliked it for its sort of redundancy and its terrible story.
Well, sounds like life.
But anyway, so what I've been watching, so I've actually, you know, watched a bunch of stuff, of course, over the past couple of weeks, but the things I want to focus on is I actually went back and caught all the animated films that I had missed prior, that were coming up to the Oscars, stuff that had been nominated for Oscars.
Stuff like Coraline, or...
Well, so it's not just Coraline. So I'd only seen WALL-E. I hadn't seen Bolt or Kung Fu Panda, which were the other two animated films nominated for an Academy Award. So I managed to acquire copies of Bolt and Kung Fu Panda, and
through various means.
Through my sources, and watched them. And I was pleasantly surprised by one, and unpleasantly surprised by the other. And I will let... Scott, I'll let you guess. Which one do you think I was pleasantly surprised by, and which one do you think I was unpleasantly surprised by?
Well, either you'll run contrary to popular opinion and be pleasantly surprised by the Jack Black flick of unspeakable stupidness, or you will be pleasantly surprised by a certain bolt of inspiration.
You were right the first time. Kung Fu Panda is actually a really entertaining movie. And Bolt was a piece of junk. I hated Bolt. I thought it was terrible.
I found it redeeming for its, you know, hamster related.
See, but things. I thought the hamster was stupid. Like, he didn't add that much to it. Like, his comedy was...
He didn't add anything. Just occasional, absolutely perfect-pitched comic delivery.
I totally disagree. I felt like all his lines were really stereotypical, and he didn't seem to have his own personality. He was just, like, throwing different random quotes out there and trying to make some sort of reference, but not buying into that reference.
He's a hamster. His heart beats 5 times a second.
I don't know. I found it not very interesting at all. And John Travolta is a terrible voice actor, and Miley Cyrus should not be allowed near a microphone.
There were a couple of humorous in-jokes that I liked at the beginning of this film. First, the stuff sort of deliberately making fun of network television, which you may have picked up on.
Yeah.
And also the reference to a Teen Vogue shoot for the Miley Cyrus character, which is a reference to her controversial photo shoot
with
the
Real Vogue
with Annie Leibovitz.
Right.
Yeah. Who we'll also mention later. In this podcast.
But no, I thought Bolt, like, the story was like Homeward Bound, only wrapped up again in a slightly different package, only a very boring package. And I thought Kung Fu Panda, like, I thought it actually really, like, it wasn't incredibly funny, and there were definitely a lot of jokes, like in all DreamWorks animation movies, that just didn't really nail anything. Like, they just weren't very funny. But in the long run, there were some really cool visuals with Kung Fu Panda, and I think the thing it had going for it is that sort of, you know, Kung Fu and karate just, you know, begs to be animated, and they got to do all these cool things that you can get away with because you're a cartoon that you can't do when you're trying to do The Matrix and you're trying to replace people with computer-generated versions of themselves. And it's really fun.
Unless if the actor you've hired already is a computer-generated version of themselves, like Keanu Reeves.
Exactly. But, no, I actually thought Kung Fu Panda was, you know, it's not a great film, it wasn't WALL-E, but it was really entertaining, and I would totally recommend that, especially if you can get a hold of the Blu-ray release when it comes out, because it's a really pretty picture too. So, but yeah, so
as are when they're synthetically generated at the final resolution.
Yes, but yeah, so Bolt sucks, and Kung Fu Panda is awesome, or at least relatively awesome. At least that's
make sure you remember that my opinion is on the contrary.
Have you seen Kung Fu Panda?
No, well, then because I boycotted it.
Then you can't have an opinion. Because I boycott all DreamWorks animation stuff because they all suck. But Kung Fu Panda was actually pretty good, so I gave it a chance.
Stand correct.
So what I've been playing is of course, playing a lot of stuff too. I went, bought and played through Fear 2, the full version of that for Xbox 360.
Very.
It was fun, but it was actually, so the mechanics of it are tight, super tight, really very nice. But the story itself kind of bogs down, and actually the scare factor, I think, sort of bogs down in the end. And the ending of Fear 2 is...
You can only be grabbed by a scary little girl so many times.
Yeah, like, the ending of Fear 2 is also just really bizarre, and I'm not quite sure what happened, and it made me kind of feel sick and gross at the end, so it kind of let me down at the end. Like, it didn't feel like it had a great climax like the first one did. So, because the first one, like, you end, like, after you just, like, set off this reactor to go, you're, like, trying to run out of this facility that's blowing up, and you're having, like, all these creepy little, like, ghost things being unleashed on you, and you have to, like, shoot them all as you're trying to run out, and it's actually really difficult and really scary, but this one, not so much. But I've also been playing another great first-person shooter sequel, this time for the poor PS3, which doesn't seem to get any love. Size Little Big Planet, and that is Killzone 2, and I have to say, Killzone 2 is the most beautiful game I've ever seen. It is top-notch, awesome-looking.
Disclaimer, we did not play Far Cry 2.
This is having seen, I haven't seen Far Cry 2, but having seen Crysis, which looked pretty good, but they just nail so many cool visual things with Killzone 2, and they had a big bar to live up to, because they were notorious for releasing this trailer at the first E3 when they made an announcement, and this trailer was obviously a cutscene pre-rendered, and they were like, oh no, this is an engine, you know, this is how it's going to look, and we're like, yeah, sure it is. And so of course the next year they, or like 2 years later, I think they released they had a demo of it, and you could tell they had done everything they could to try to replicate this pre-rendered cutscene, and it wasn't quite there, but either way, having that sort of goal set that, you know, we told everyone that this pre-rendered CG cutscene was how we're going to look, they actually did a pretty good job of making it look really great. Though, that's the good part about it. The sucky part about it is that it's on the PS3, and I have to use the PS3 controller, and the PS3 controller sucks. Absolutely sucks. And the controls, that how it works, the PS3 controller, absolutely suck. Like, I feel like I don't know how to play a first-person shooter anymore, which is this weird contrast, because Fear 2, everything is perfect and tight, and I was, like, getting headshot after headshot, because, you know, everything just feels so good. And Killzone 2, there's, like, this lag when you try to move and you try to aim. There's, like, a half a second lag between when you move the control stick and you actually move, your character moves his weapon, and that almost completely destroys the game. Like, I've learned how to sort of get around it, but it really is unfortunate that they had to release this game on PS3, because it's just that control stuff is a big barrier for entry for me to, you know, really, really love this game. But
that sounds pretty tragic.
Yeah, so I've been looking desperately to try to find a mod so I can use my 360 controller with the PS3, and
that won't be suppressed by Sony Home Entertainment.
Well, hey, you can run Linux on it, right? It's a development platform, so why not? But anyway, I think that's basically the big points I wanted to talk about. Do you have anything else you want to talk about?
That's so much stuff to watch and play.
Sure.
We should just gotta get to it.
Okay, so so that's that. So let's move on to the big and exciting review of this week, which is of course Zack Snyder's adaptation of the Alan Moore comic book Watchmen.
Oh, I'll catch up with you guys. I think I left my watch inside.
Hey, just wait a second.
I cross the room to the intrinsic field center. I find my watch. When I get to the door, Wally is turning white.
The program's locked in. We can't override the time lock.
I am terrified.
John! I'm sorry, John. But I can't.
Hey, don't leave me! Stop sleeping!
Okay, so Watchmen. There's a lot of hype built up around this, and
most not like we would contribute to that.
Of course not.
At DailyMonotony.com.
Not like we would theme our website nor have a week devoted to Watchmen stories. But so anyway, the reason why Watchmen is so popular for all the rest of you who haven't read the graphic novel is that this graphic novel came out in 1986, written by Alan Moore, and it was groundbreaking in its nature. It really changed comic books from being these sort of happy, fun action hero stories to being this sort of dark, nihilistic, violent, you know, including, you know, adult sexual themes into it, really sort of changed the scope of what graphic novels and comic books were, from being very much a kid's genre to being this very open and adult genre where you could actually produce these very broad scope and very challenging pieces of literature for people to read. And of course, you know, it took off. People loved it. I think Time magazine put it on their 100 best English language novels since 1923, and that was hugely controversial because it's a comic book, and people were like, well, that's not a novel, that's not a book, and you know, Time's response is like, read this thing. Yes, it is. This is literature. This is not just comic books. So
the response also being, well, we're Time magazine.
Oh, that's a good point. But so anyway, there's tons of lore behind this IP, behind this story. And for the longest time, Alan Moore himself sort of said, this cannot be turned into a movie. I've made this comic book to prove how comic books can do things that literature can't and movies can't. And so for a long time, no one would touch this thing because it was just so, so very difficult. And there's so many weaving threads to turn into a movie. But that didn't stop Zack Snyder. He made 300, which was a Frank Miller comic book. And he said, heck, if I can do that, I can tackle the untackleable, which was Watchmen. And he did, and it's out. And Mr. Scott Johnsgaard, what did you think?
Well, it's a long film.
It is a long film.
And yeah. Some people would think that it's complicated, but that's not true at all. It's, in fact, a lot of very simple stuff. This film... Okay, it's not 400.
No,
which is what I wanted it to be desperately. 300 was an incredibly transportive film. You could practically imagine yourself in this sort of painterly, visually poetic ancient Greece, you know.
Sure.
It was a very incredible film, visually striking, very transportive, very memorable. I wanted that in this film. And for the first act, they flirt with that and almost sort of give it to you. And the rest of the film is just a series of exercises and sort of passing the time so that they can complete the plot of the comic book. Obviously, a good plot should be character-driven. There are plenty of characters in this. There is one compelling character, Rorschach. You're really going to like everything, well, almost everything that he has to say.
Sure.
A lot of the little sort of meandering side stories that they have involving him are very engaging, very impelling. You like to get behind that. He's the only person that I ever liked. Everyone else seemed like a complete waste of my time. Especially, you know, this whole, you know, Silk Spectre romance,
yes.
Whatever the hell all that stuff is going on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a character, the comedian, who you might find sort of interesting as being the logical point of a parody. How do you make fun of human nature? Well, you take it to its logical conclusion, even though that's what you're protesting.
Sure, right.
What can you say? But other than that, I thought this film was very inconsistent, very sort of meandering. You know, there's a lot of things that we can talk about in terms of the technical regard and stuff that I liked. But as far as the actual story is concerned in the presentation... It's a weak C.
Huh.
You know.
Interesting. So I liked the movie. I thought it was good. It didn't strike me the same way that the previous sort of big comic book movie was, which was The Dark Knight. You know, I came out of that, like I said, you know, feeling electrified and just, you know, this is the reason why I love films and love cinema.
You weren't ecstatic after The Spirit?
No, wasn't quite, wasn't quite there after The Spirit. But yeah, I sort of got the same feeling. There are some things that are just really well done in this movie. Like, there are certain scenes in this movie that are, you know, that gave me goosebumps and were just, you know, perfectly done. But the rest of it feels a bit flat. And so I actually, you know, I've read the comic book. I'm a huge fan of the comic book. And they do a great job of almost matching scene for scene stuff from the comic book and pulling it straight out of the comic book and putting it on the screen, remaking the, you know, exact visual images that you'd see in the comic book panes, pulling dialogue almost one for one exactly out of the comic book. And while I'm glad they did that, like, you know, it's good that I guess they're sticking to the story. I feel like that sort of brought it down a little bit because there's some things that you can say and you can write down, I guess, and you can let people read that work. And when you have an actor say it, it just doesn't really sound right. It doesn't come out well. And I felt that bar wasn't really set well. Like, they should have
been... Don't diminish their dialogue bubbles.
They should have been looking at those dialogue bubbles and be like, okay, I can read that, but I can't really say that on stage. Like, that's not how people talk. So I wish they had done a bit more of that there. I guess one of the big problems with The Watchmen, that's one of the nice things about being able to take it slowly with the comic book, is there really is a lot of plot, and there's a lot of subtlety, there's a lot of symbolism, there's a lot of, you know, different side paths talking about different concepts and different philosophies, and you really get to take your time to go into that in the comic book. And, you know, even in a 2-hour and 40-minute movie, that's not a lot of time to really get into dissecting the story and really getting people to understand what's going on and get people emotionally attached to a certain thing. So when you cause everything to sort of, you know, tumultuously flip at the end, people feel like, you know, that there's this sense of like, oh no, what the heck, that, you know, that can't be. And, you know, to have that sort of affecting reveal and like The Watchmen does, which actually has several of them at the end. And I felt
it could be argued.
I felt they really didn't like, by being too close to the story, they sort of lost their chance, I think, to make this an excellent movie and not just a good movie. And from that standpoint, I think the reason it is a good movie, and I guess we can sort of transition into talking about some of the technical aspects of it, is that this is a beautiful movie. I really love Zack Snyder's style and his cinematography. I love his speed ramping that he does in fight scenes. You know, it's very famous for doing that in 300. I thought it was pulled off really well here. I don't think there was enough of it, which is why I think it sort of suffered. But yeah, visually, I think this movie was spot on. Maybe not as transportive as the sort of mono or the duotone 300 environment, but still just beautiful to look at. Beautiful set designs, beautiful color work. What would you say your opinion is there, Scott?
I think if we took Watchmen and The Spirit and collided them together, we might actually get a good visual style. The biggest problem is those jumps you were talking about, those fluid jumps from normal motion to what you would call overcranked,
yeah, so speed
slow
ramping,
motion,
yeah,
or high speed camera work, if you will.
Sure.
All of those in the film were in the trailer.
Kind of, yeah.
To some extent, you've already seen all that you're going to see if you've sat through any other films in the last 3 months.
Yeah.
And I really wanted that. It's juicy. It's delicious.
Sure.
And there wasn't nearly enough of it. You know, most of it's in the first 5, 10
sure.
minutes of the film.
Right, which is, and I would actually say the first 20 minutes of this film, so like the opening scene where, and this is not a spoiler, but, you know, where the comedian gets thrown out the window, which you see in the trailer. So that is this, you know, this really cool fight scene done with speed ramping, done, oh gosh, what music do they play in the background? They're playing like, oh gosh, it's either Billie Holiday or it's Nat King Cole, and it's so such a cool scene. Like, I really thought this movie started off incredibly strong, and then they transition directly into that, which I think is probably one of the most transcendental movie scenes I've ever seen, which is the opening credits to this movie, which is done to The Times They Are Changing, and all done with the concept of a sort of a picture, a like 3D picture sort of frozen in time or moving very slowly, of, and that kind of giving you the backstory of all the characters and all the original masked heroes. And so most of the movie is based on the sort of second wave, almost like Wuthering Heights kind of second generation of a certain character set. And rather than going deep into the backstory, which they do in the comic book of this sort of first generation of comic book heroes, they give you this all. They show all that stuff in the opening credit sequence, which is absolutely beautiful. And I think just that credit sequence deserves some kind of award because it's so cool.
Right. The first act of this film is very, very affecting, very transportive. You're not going to be able to look away.
Yeah.
And that's what I like the most about this movie. The rest of the movie, I think, sort of fails. You mentioned two things I want to talk about. It's a movie that uses a lot of different interesting music choices.
Yeah.
And critically, some people have thought whoever their music editor was needs to be fired, and other people have said is genius. I'm sort of more in the first category, I'm afraid.
Oh, really?
There's a lot of, I mean, there is some genius there, like at the beginning, like what you said, Times They Are Changing and stuff like
sure.
that, which is really fantastic, and other things which seem completely sort of
like
eclectic, like having Simon and Garfunkel during a funeral or yeah. having Leonard Cohen during some mad shagging action.
Okay, so the Leonard Cohen hallelujah during the sex scene was, I have no idea what they were thinking there. Like, it made it very comical, which it kind of is, like, that. So that scene is sort of supposed to be comical, and I'm trying not to be too spoilery here, but But yeah, I agree. Like, I don't. That was the one big. That's. I liked all the music choices up to that point. That's where I kind of went, meh, really?
Yeah, and as an aside about the sex in this movie, it is about as graphic as you can get in an R. Roundabouts. It's close to the line.
I would disagree with that, but it is.
It made me very uncomfortable for your local, you know,
it
particularly
is,
conscientious
it is,
individual.
Oh, it is graphic. So I mean, it's not. There's I guess a whole lot of blatant nudity in it, but there's a lot of suggested what's going on sort of thing, and it's a pretty drawn out sex scene too. But it actually serves a purpose in the narrative, at least
there
it did.
Is motion of the ocean.
Yes, at least it did in the Watchmen comic book, but I really felt that scene was sort of not well played out in this. But that's, I guess that kind of segues into one of my big complaints about this movie, which was Malin Ackerman, who played Laurie Jupiter, the Silk Spectre 2, who was the daughter of the original Silk Spectre. I felt her performance across the board was, like, forgettable to tragic.
Yeah. I'll expand that. Patrick Wilson, who played Dan Dreiberg / the Night Owl number 2, right, as well as Malin Ackerman, not only were their characters, shall I say, written flatly, perhaps converted flatly from the graphic novel, but also just completely flat and instantly forgettable performances.
Sure. No,
and for trying to make them almost the centerpiece of the film, is really, I think, its biggest weak point.
Which for a good portion of it, they really are. Like, so the right. character of Rorschach really is, or Rorschach is the kind of, the sort of common thread which gets you from the beginning to the end, but the Night Owl and Silk Spectre really do play a big part in the middle, and
the beat of the second act.
And so for Patrick Wilson's performance, so the Dan Dreiberg character was really supposed to be a symbolic sort of comic book reader, like the geek, the person who doesn't really have an identity and is forced to find an identity by putting on a mask. And so I felt a bit better, or I guess maybe I can, what am I trying to say? I can say I will give some lenience to Patrick Wilson in that part, because I feel like he sort of played the way that the character was sort of supposed to be, but it wasn't great. It wasn't as memorable as, you know, as Jackie Earle Haley's performance of Rorschach, or even Billy Crudup's performance of Dr. Manhattan, which at first when he first started talking, I felt like I wanted to shout out, like, no, that's wrong, this is terrible. But by the end of the movie, I was like, that's genius. Like, Billy Crudup has done something truly amazing here. So what did you think of the Dr. Manhattan character?
I personally found him to be sort of completely unlikable, for the lack of, you know, a lot of the other characters in the film accuse him of being unable to understand humanity or not having any humanity left.
Right.
I think that's a good critique.
Sure. Which, I mean, is really what his character is supposed to be. Though what I found is that there was some nice subtlety of human emotion in there, and really that character is supposed to represent, you know, this godlike force who does have humanity but refuses to acknowledge his own humanity and tries to distance himself from his own humanity. And I felt like that really came across. So personally, you know, knowing a bit more about the character, having read the comic book, I felt like it really came across well as this person who's aloof from everything that he looks at and sort of disinterested in everything he looks at, with twinges of humanity sort of coming up. So yeah, I actually thought it was well done, but that may be one of those things where, you know, they sort of fail to get that across, because, you know, I got that because I watched or read the comic book, but other people are not going to get that because they didn't have that background.
Right, and I'm completely naive to the original comic, so,
sure,
you know, it's just the film in me, so to speak.
Yep. So what did you? Let's see. Do you have anything else you want to say before we go into spoiler territory? And we're actually gonna call a point so people can stop listening if they don't want to hear spoilers about it.
Maybe this is quasi, you know, like what you said during the beginning. Their sort of historical reimagining is one of the things I found the most interesting in the film. Would you consider that a spoiler?
No, I don't think so.
Talking about those. Okay. I really liked a lot of the parodies they did of stuff that's going on. In the opening sequence, the interview with Adrian Voigt, they had a Capote character and a Nanny Leibovitz character.
Right.
Both of which were fantastic parodies of the actual people. Though really, strangely, they showed Annie Leibovitz using a view camera, and I don't think she uses those. I think she uses Hasselblads, but that's okay. You know,
right.
Nobody who's a photographer is going to watch this movie except people who do.
Sure.
And a lot of other fun historical reimaginings. Their Nixon could, you know, we could spend a lot of time comparing it to the Nixon and Frost Nixon.
Yeah.
More of a parody here and less of a reinvigoration, but one that you'll enjoy if you're anything of a presidential scholar.
Sure.
They also conflated the flower girl placing the daisy and the rifle with the Kent State shooting,
yeah.
Which irritated me a little.
Well, yeah, but you have to admit that
they're different events, but I know what they're trying to do.
And still a visually awesome scene.
The entire opening sequence where they show you sort of these historical reimaginings are really fantastic.
Yeah.
And you'll get pulled in them. The one thing that I don't like is their reimagination of the Kennedy assassination. you know, in 300, we spent a lot of time enjoying the gore.
Right.
You know, little chunks flying through air while we lovingly watch as it's all in slow motion.
Right.
Sort of getting the same sort of like orgasmic, you know, gore porn feeling out of that when we're talking about the Kennedy assassination, and it's so realistically depicted, and it's like, you know, well,
yeah.
There's Jack Kennedy going after a chunk.
Right.
That bothered me a lot.
Huh.
I like, you know, it's fine if we want to sit and enjoy the gore in a fictional story, but if it's a vivid depiction of something that actually happened, and, you know,
sure.
On some level, those are real people in another universe,
sure.
It sort of bothers me.
Yeah.
Nobody else seems to have felt the same way, but that really pushed me over the edge.
Yeah, I didn't really have as much a problem there. It felt like a pretty good recreation of the original stock photography, complete with a sort of, you know, pink cloud and chunks on the car. So I actually found it to be a really well done scene for really kind of recapturing that famous footage that we have, but yeah, it didn't slow motion
and I think relishing those chunks a little bit too much.
I don't think that scene was done in slow motion. Like that one actually felt like it's much more done of like here's a recreation of this famous video, only we see it all sort of going out, and then, you know, we turn and we see that it's, you know, the comedian who shot Kennedy, but. Yeah, I will agree that at some point, like, as we get later on and, like, you know, the sort of ultra-violence, gore, Zack Snyderism sort of get introduced, I actually felt some of those, I felt unneeded. Like, there are certain parts where it was just, like, it felt like it's being gory just to be gory, and there's, like... And,
yeah, I think they were trying to be 400.
And like...
They wanted to give that to us because we wanted it,
and I felt like that was a little crass in some ways. It was, like... So in the comic book, like the fight scenes that they have, like especially there's one involving Silk Spectre and the Night Owl, was not nearly as violent in the comic book. And the comic book, you know, actually does a pretty strong thing to be violent and to be disturbing and be shocking. And while I understand that, you know, Zack Snyder's trying to make the appropriate transition to our modern era where we're very used to seeing, you know, gore and violence, it just still felt like, you know, like, this is unnecessary. Like, do I really need to see, you know, a guy's arm get broken in half and, like, his bone go flying out the other side? Like, no. Like, you can kick him, or you can get knocked down, or, you know...
Already seen it in the Volcano movie with Pierce Brosnan?
Yeah, I mean, it's like that, and those points just felt like Zack Snyder being ultra-violent to be ultra-violent. And,
violence for the sake of violence.
Yeah, so, I agree, some of that detracted from the movie instead of sort of adding to it. Which is unfortunate. But I think we're going to call that the end of our non-spoiler section. So if you haven't seen the movie and you still want to see the movie, I'm going to go ahead and say my recommendations is go see this movie if you're at all interested in it. I think there are a lot of things worth seeing in this movie. A lot of really cool scenes, a lot of scenes that gave me goosebumps. And even if the overall effect was not as outstanding as, let's say, The Dark Knight was, I think you're going to at least pull away something interesting from this film, whatever it is that you enjoy from it. And if nothing else, maybe it'll get you to go read the source material, which is quite excellent.
I guess I'll agree with that. It's a weak recommend for me. If you had tolerance for something like 300, you can watch this. If you don't, I wouldn't see it. It's 2.5 hours of that kind of stuff.
Cool. Well, we're now going into spoiler territory, so...
Dark waters.
So, first and foremost, so the ending of this movie, basically we learn that the main bad guy, Adrian Veidt, who is sort of this set up as this kind of Alexander the Great character, he twists everything around to basically obliterate five cities in, you know, the world, to bring everyone together by making everyone think that Dr. Manhattan had obliterated these cities, which is actually a change from the original comic book ending. But the original comic book,
there was an octopus involved.
There was a squid, a giant space squid in the original.
I don't mean to conflate all of the basic sea creatures.
Sure, there's a giant mutated genetically engineered space squid in the original ending, which was supposed to make everyone join together because now they thought there's this common alien threat that was coming. But they changed it around because I really don't think a giant squid would have flown very well with audiences, especially if you don't have time to think about it and digest it. And so they made the main switch being the world's animosity being pushed toward Dr. Manhattan, and that being the unifying effect. I actually felt it sort of worked, but Scott, what did you think about the ending? Did you find it surprising, or did they catch you off guard with that, or was it sort of predictable and sort of stupid?
You know, the Fringe turns on us, but he's the smartest and apparently fastest guy in the world, sure, so he can pull it all off. Even though the omnipotent person doesn't get it because of some Star Trek technology.
Because of tachyons, well, right?
No, I'll let that pass by gently and go into the night. I'm not too worried about that. Really, the biggest problem I had with the ending was the way that the only sympathetic or at all interesting character in the film plays out, Rorschach. Suddenly, after spending the entire film being something of a utilitarian in my mind, mm-hmm, going around thinking that the end justifies the means, he can be very mean to bad guys as long as it stops further badness.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly believes he needs to stand up on an objective moral principle after something bad has been done that will achieve much goodness for mankind. He suddenly feels like he needs to go out and change that. It seems exactly what it seems like his project for the entire film has just been accomplished, and now he's very upset about it and needs to be detonated.
So the character of Rorschach is having the background from the comic book, the only thing he's devoted to is truth and the justice. Everything else, you know, sort of stands in the way. I would almost relate him to the assassin character from Serenity, the sort of person who, like, I know I've done terrible things, and there's no place for me in that perfect world, but I will do everything I must for this singular purpose. And for Rorschach, that purpose is justice, and justice must be served. And if someone has done wrong, I will, you know, kill, maim, and I will become the monster to make sure that sort of retribution is served. And so I actually felt it really is keeping with this character, that even though this terrible thing has been done to unite humanity, so basically, you know, millions have been killed in order to save billions, this very Machiavellian act has occurred, Rorschach, you know, he doesn't care. You know, he says, you know, no compromise, you know, and it doesn't matter that, you know, the world is going to become this nice, happy commune. You know, all he cares about is that justice needs to be served, and the justice that needs to be served is that Adrian Veidt has killed all these comic book heroes and has also now killed millions of people around the world, and he's going to make sure they know about it. And we also we get hinted at the end, both the end of the comic book and the end of the movie, that, you know, his journal is left behind with this paper company called the New Frontiersman, and that actually might come out, and we actually might see sort of the truth. That's the only hopeful bit we get out of the end of this movie, is that the truth itself actually may survive the destruction of Rorschach. But
which is the problem? Why does he then volunteer to be destroyed, since he's already let the truth out?
Because the whole point is that he knows he's not.
I understand why he feels like he needs to walk out on principle, although in my opinion that doesn't mesh with the rest of his actions.
Sure.
Maybe I can understand that he wants the truth to come out about who actually did all of these things, but, you know, he has to understand that that would destroy the saving
but that's,
billions.
That's the point. He doesn't care. He doesn't care about saving billions and millions. He cares about justice, and justice has to be served. And the only way for justice to be served is to let people know the truth of what Adrian Veidt had done. So that's his commitment to it, and to the point that he's willing, you know, knowing that Dr. Manhattan is not going to let him leave, and not going to let him leave unscathed. He, you know, basically says, you know, I would rather not live than be in a world where justice is not served, where this lie has been made in order to save humanity. And I actually found that both in the comic book and even in this movie to be one of the more sort of potent and moving parts of moving scenes. And I actually felt like it was really well done, because I really loved Jackie Earle Haley's performance, and I thought this sort of he had this, you know, sort of huge mix of emotions at the end, where he's basically, you know, knowing that Dr. Manhattan is not going to let him leave. You know, he, you know, goes from sort of like being afraid and sad to resolute and angry within like 3 seconds, and it's so beautifully done in his, both his voice and sort of his facial emotions and his sort of facial twitchings. I thought that was beautiful, and I really wish they could have let that settle and linger a bit longer, because I think that's really the biggest and most heart-wrenching part of the story. That, and I felt like it just kind of like shoved aside. It was like, okay, we've done that part. We, you know, check box. Let's move on to the next scene. Well, let me pull out the comic book and find out which scene that is. So
yeah, in the job he was able to do, playing the character of Rorschach, spending most of the film behind a mask, was pretty spectacular. Sort of like V for Vendetta,
sure.
Only not sucky.
Right. Only not Wachowski. But yeah, like there's so many. Like, so I want to talk about some of the great scenes that I really loved in this movie. I felt the whole background story, the sort of, or the origin story of Dr. Manhattan, that done to the Philip Glass music from Kojonaskatsi was just perfect and beautiful. I actually felt they really nailed the sort of temporal bit where he's sort of saying, like, this didn't happen to me, but it's happening right now. I thought they actually pulled that across really well, and that's one of the things I was sort of worried about, because that whole sort of comic book chapter is all over the place, where, like, one frame is, like, you know, this 2 seconds in the future, and the next frame is 50 years in the past, and the next frame is 3 seconds in the future, and they do this whole trying to make you understand that he sees time all at once rather than seeing it linearly. And I actually felt that whole sort of sequence was really cool and really well done, and also really, really well matched with the music that they brought into that scene. Did you like it? Did you enjoy that part? Or
it reminded me too much of the Sandman creation scene from Spider-Man 3.
Oh, really?
Which makes me automatically reject things anytime they remind me of Spider-Man 3.
Ouch, that's pretty harsh.
That is pretty harsh. I found it difficult to find any part of the Dr. Manhattan material very compelling, I'm afraid. You know, like you said, his lack of humanity, in these terms, sort of translated into a flatness.
Sure.
That was hard for me to get behind.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's unfortunate, because, I mean, there really is that part of him that is supposed to be the lingering humanity, and we only ever see it once in the movie, which is where he is being questioned and being accused of giving people cancer, and he sort of loses his ability to push his humanity away, and, you know, suddenly, you know, breaks out in this big yell and suddenly transports himself to Mars. But yeah, I think it's fair criticism, and, you know, I don't feel like I can really judge it, you know, having all that backstory baked into my brain already and sort of like expectation and knowing what the character is. So I'm sure more people will have this similar comments for Dr. Manhattan character, which is you know, you have to question, is that just a problem of cinema not being able to handle something as complex as Watchmen, or is it Zack Snyder's inability to get that across to people?
I feel like I need to take notes and watch the film again.
It does really feel like a film you need to watch again, and I actually think I may...
Which would be painful, because it's so unendingly long.
It is pretty long, but I think there's...
I would rather pay the $4 I have to pay to get in and watch the first 30 minutes and then just be very content that I could see that again.
Sure. Yeah. I guess that is, you know, the unfortunate bit about having such a long, complex story, is that there really is a lot of exposition you have to sort of wade through before you can get to the next cool action scene.
But
or
the
cool
exposition
scene
is the juicy and interesting part, is the transportive part, is the compelling part.
Sure, but it's also the part I think that works.
And after that, the actual story is just kind of, you know...
Well, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, the exposition is also the part that I think works better in a book or in a comic book and not so well in movies. And I think that's
so
something...
So props to them for making it work.
Well, I mean, you understood it, but did you enjoy those long exposition scenes?
Well, the long exposition scene, the first 45 minutes of the film, is what I liked.
Huh.
I'd like to be perfectly clear. The first act of this film I absolutely loved, and the next two were almost sort of, were, you know, D's.
So why was that? Like, was it the action you did not feel was fulfilling, or the visual style not fulfilling, or is the, I want to know more about what's going on and have less, you know, burning buildings and slow-mo?
The action was infrequent. It felt a little too violent and not stylized enough. I'm afraid it wasn't quite 300 enough. Ditto for the visual style wasn't quite 300 enough. And as I've said, sort of the plot after it's been set up, you know, at first it's sort of interesting. It's sort of a thriller mystery for me with Rorschach coming in doing this dialogue, voiceover, sure. narration kind of thing. Sort of reminding me of The Spirit very much, very
yeah,
strong.
Yeah, almost like an anti-Spirit. Like that first commentary is, you know, about how terrible the city is and about how, you know, he hates the city, and whereas The Spirit is, you know, like how he loves the city and the city is his mother, and so
precisely
right.
Yeah, and it's no stupid cats.
right.
Not like I have anything against our feline allies, but you know, so that was sort of interesting, and as this history was being set up, you know, I didn't quite know who the Watchmen were. The first Watchmen, the second Watchmen, getting all the chronology in order, that was fascinating. Their historical reimaginings.
Sure.
Sort of the initial character setups, you know, that was all very interesting. Then sort of as soon as the rest of it came out, as soon as the Night Owl, Silk Inspector stuff started going, the film really lost me. It just didn't seem very compelling or transportive. I'd already been transported, and then it wasn't a very interesting place I'd gotten.
But would you say that, so that's because you feel like the action was not stylized enough, and maybe the characters they focused on during the second act were
absolutely
not as interesting?
I mean, I can live without the action.
Sure.
You know, I can absolutely live without the action. I liked Frost Nixon. That doesn't have any action in it at all.
Sure.
But, you know, the plot just wasn't there. These characters weren't pushing me, except for Rorschach. Anytime he was on the screen, I was happy.
Right.
You know.
But he had
his own style of fighting that was great. He,
sure.
he had these great dialogues.
But I mean, that would almost say that it was the character. Like you didn't care for the characters and that their story, or at least like so the Night Owl, Silk Spectre stuff, which was really kind of the crux of the second act of this movie. But not necessarily the. Well, I don't know. It, to me, it more sounds like, you know, it's as long as Rorschach's on there and we're getting his story, it's cool. But beyond, if it's someone else and sort of some of the weaker acting performances, it's not quite as interesting, I guess.
That's right. And I mean, I'm a, you know, plot for me is only where characters are going. You
sure.
know, if there's a plot going on in the background involving, you know, nothing that's human, I won't even
right.
pay
attention. Which is unfortunate, because I felt in the comic book the plot with Dr. Manhattan and sort of him being on Mars and him trying to convince himself that humanity is less interesting to him than subatomic particles is actually a really cool and thought-provoking moment. And the thing I think where that really sort of died off in this movie is that the Silk Spectre character is really supposed to provide. She comes there and she actually provides this very sort of, you know, frustrated talking to someone who's really not listening to me, someone who's really working something out himself, and she's just sort of the channel for him to work that out. Like, she, to me, she just like sort of appears on Mars and she's kind of like, oh, I don't understand what's going on and blah 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 blah. Why don't you, you know, just take me down? This is too much. I don't understand this. And oh, by the way, my father was the comedian. It's like that. None of that stuff really came across and came across as being very interesting. Whereas in the book, like, you spend so much time learning about how she, like, hates the comedian so much and how her sort of relationship with Dr. Manhattan is so sort of is so much tension and stress between it that sequence in the comic book really plays out well. And when it comes down to the point that she learns that her father is the comedian, the person she hates the most in the world, that's that paradox that causes Dr. Manhattan to suddenly say that the most interesting and most random chaotic thing in the world is humanity and life. That part just really didn't come across, and unfortunately, like, that's the sort of the big sort of linchpin event you need to get across in this movie or in the story to have everything else make sense after that. And I really feel like because they failed there, they sort of failed to, I think, grab people's attention toward the last bit of the movie, or at least make it as impactful as it should have been.
I can see that. I can see now that you've explained it. I have some sympathy for the comic book and fans of it at this point. That sounds
sure.
very interesting, but whatever you just said didn't happen in the movie.
Yeah, there's definitely stuff that they cut from the movie that I wish they sort of could have taken some of the expositionary parts where it's like Night Owl and Silk Spectre talking to each other or talking to her mom or just in a room talking and doing nothing. Like, I wish they could have cut more of that stuff and put in more Dr. Manhattan, you know, thinking about things and working out his own humanity and working out his
or
own...
Or more Rorschach.
Or more Rorschach. Well, unfortunately, like most of what you see of Rorschach in the in the movie is actually just straight from the comic book. Like, there really isn't much more to his story. It's very much, the same. And I think there's only a couple scenes where they kind of cut Rorschach's character out, and that's because he's such an awesome character. But no, I agree. He's definitely, I think, you know, he's the most interesting character in the story, and also probably the most well acted character too. So that sort of doubly made him this sort of more interesting person. And when he really wasn't leading
the Vale School of Vocal Delivery.
Sure. Though, okay, that's actually an interesting point.
It's my city.
I felt like he pulled off the grumbly voice very naturally, whereas like Christian Bale's in Batman feels very forced and very, very stupid. Like, I actually could believe that, you know,
I'm wearing mask.
Right. I can actually believe that Jackie Earl Haley goes around talking in the grumbly voice, and it didn't feel forced. It felt like it was like a natural grumble mixed with his normal sort of low vocal tones, and I thought it worked really well. Like, I was afraid that was going to be really jarring, but I think it actually worked. So, what did you think of that?
Initially, all I could think of was Batman, because it seems so similar. But at length, it was not nearly as jarring as Batman tends to be. So I'm fine with it. And, you know, halfway through this film, you know, an hour and a half into it, you know, of course you're going to like it, because it's the only interesting thing on the screen.
Right. Cool. Well, I think we've...
Simple.
I think we've probably dissected this thing about as much as we can in an hour's worth of time. So,
question.
Go ahead.
It's not at all addressed in the film, which maybe the comic book can help me out with as somebody completely naive to it. Now, these heroes, it seems like they're ordinary people, but they kind of have superpowers, with the exception of Dr. Manhattan, who's sort of off in a special class.
Sure.
What's up with that? They seem faster and stronger than normal people, but otherwise perfectly mortal and
so
sort of
they really are supposed to be just normal people, you know, who they're supposed to be Batmans. They're supposed to be, you know, some of them have like slight, you know, special technologies and stuff like that, but other than that, they're just ordinary people. And I think you sort of got across the fact that they might be superhuman strength or superhuman speed from the movie, but I think that's just more of the visual stylings of Zack Snyder showing people fighting. But they are really supposed to be just like people who dress up in costumes that they made themselves. And I think maybe Adrian.
So their invincibility, which sort of seems to surround them, is more luck than it is.
More luck and more training than it is superpowers.
You know, because they'll very casually face off with the gang.
Oh, sure, but that's because they're, you know, imagine, you know, they were trained martial artists or something like that, and they're going against a bunch of street thugs. I mean, that's how they're able to do so well. Is they're just, you know, they're people who've been well trained in combat. And it's about going up against people who you don't expect people to fight back, so... But yeah, they're most definitely not supposed to be superhuman, except for Dr. Manhattan, who is supposed to be the culmination of every superhero character put together, and what you get in the end is God, which is what Dr. Manhattan is in this movie.
Right. Plus the Ozymandias.
Yeah, so Ozymandias, or the Adrian Veidt character, he's not supposed to be, he's just supposed to be really smart and really egotistic.
Really fat.
But beyond that, beyond that, he's really just supposed to be human. He's just, you know, imagine like the smartest man in the world who has studied everything, and you know, that's why he could catch bullets and stuff like that, is because he is that smart.
He knows gun kata.
He knows gun kata, right. I was actually going to say that, too. Final thoughts on The Watchmen at the end of the spoiler section, Scott?
Go see it if you liked 300. Go see it if you didn't like The Spirit. Otherwise, you know, it's not too late to see The Reader.
Cool, and I would say, yeah, if you're at all intrigued by the trailers you've seen about this movie, if you like a sort of twist on a comic book story, definitely go see this, especially, you know, if you have the stomach for some of the Snyderisms in it. But yeah, I would definitely say this is worth seeing, but probably not going to affect you as strongly as many other great movies. And read the comic book first and foremost. If you do that and don't watch the movie, I feel like my job is done. So yeah, I guess that's about all we have to say. Thanks for joining us on our new format of the show. We actually still ran a bit long, but
that's
heck,
okay.
It's good debate and good conversation. But again, always be sure to come back to dailymonotony.com. Check out new updates that we have. Come back next week as we'll review another movie and maybe stick a game in here. We have been known to do that from time to time. And if you have comments that you want to give us, we now have an email address. Send all your interesting comments and interesting fan mail, if you happen to be a fan, to dailymonotony@gmail.com.
And or you can just post a comment on the website.
I can just post a comment. That is a valid way of doing it. But till then, I am Dustin Anglin. Thanks for joining us.
And John Scott. Insert Nixonism here.